Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 19th, 2017, and welcome to episode 147 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting just all the fun things that we do with these old computers. And we like talking about the old computers. I just kind of get the feeling that we like old computers. So, hey, if you tuned in, just go with it, because that's what we're all about. And we've got a quorum today. Sorry that we are a week late. For the folks who tune into RCR pretty soon after it posts, you probably noticed that we dragged our feet by a week this time. We didn't have a quorum last week, and I was a bit under the weather. But, you know, we've bounced back, and here we are. The RCR might fall down, but we get up again.
We are like Chumbawamba that way.
We are, yes. You're never going to keep us down. So, and hey, since you spoke first, let's go over first and check in with the master of the raster, that Lucky Canuck, Carrington Vanston. How are you, sir?
I'm amazing. The weather here is beautiful, and like your intro says, I am old and I'm into computers. I think that's what you're saying, right? Anyway, yes, both of those are true.
Close enough. Yeah, the weather in Toronto is good at the moment?
Oh, yeah, it's like 14 degrees and sunny, and we often get a mini spring in February, and then the weather's boot comes back down on us hard.
Yikes. Well, that sounds awesome. That's a lot better than the weather I'm having here in Portland. But speaking of weather, let me check in with Paul Hagstrom, who I'm wondering, are you still digging out from the multiple snowstorms there in Boston?
Actually, no. It's surprisingly warm here, too. I think it might just about be 60 in our degrees, which is unbelievable. So, yeah, the snow takes care of itself, I guess.
Okay, well, good enough. So I guess that's 2 out of 2 with good weather. What about you, Michael? What is life like on the weather front and the personal front down under?
Well, let's do the weather front first. The last couple of weekends, it's been 40 plus in real temperature, which I think would be, nearly over 100 in Fahrenheit, but with the humidity to match. So it's been wonderful weather if you like being fried and boiled alive.
I was going to say, that's like rainforest weather.
Yeah, minus the rainforest. It just burnt. Yeah, apart from lots of bushfires and things throughout the state, so when we're not baking, we're burning. Yeah, it's just another day in summer here in beautiful Australia.
Well, okay. I'm glad you're still alive. I'm glad you're... Do you at least have air conditioning?
Yes, we have air conditioning. On that weather front, I must admit I did have the fire hoses laid out in various spots around the house. Things got a little bit I won't say they got hairy here, but the way things had gone so dry, it doesn't take much for grass fires and brush fires to just start up. And then you top it off by having these massive, great evening thunderstorms with lightning coming down all over the place. And we had a big storm last night with hail in areas the size of baseballs, so Fortunately, we missed out on that fun, so if anyone ever gets bored with the weather in their place and you want to be pummeled by hail, burnt to a crisp, or broiled in the humidity, come to Australia in summer. It's wonderful.
You are a hearty lot down there. I'm quite impressed, and I'm going to wave off complaining about any little drizzle that I'm having here in Portland.
Yeah, that's why I like going to Missouri in the U.S. summer. It sort of gives me a chance to have some balmy weather of where it's only hot, and that's the only thing that's going on. It's
gotcha. Well, very nice. All right. Well, I guess we should move on to the host topic. I'm glad everyone's doing well and either enjoying or surviving their weather experiences. We have a topic from Jorma, and I think it's a great one. And we've kind of hinted around at this topic before. We've talked around it, but never right down the middle of the road of big collections. Basically asking, what are the implications for people who have, and large is a subjective term, but large retro computing collections, lots of machines, lots of peripherals. So are we saving systems from oblivion? Meaning, I know that a lot of the systems that I have were at one point or another headed for a landfill, and I couldn't abide that. That's horrible. But now that I've got them, am I, by having them stored in the closet or whatever, removing them from the hands of enthusiasts who might otherwise be happily using them? And what are the techniques for balancing a large collection and enjoying it? I've had various people tell me that they rotate pieces of their collection through the place of honor on maybe a monthly basis or something like that, so that none of them go bad. But you know, some folks have such big collections that they have to have an annual or a biannual or something like that turn-on fest, where they go through each of the computers, power them up, and make sure that the magic smoke isn't coming out of them. I think Teza does that, for instance, with his collection from time to time, do the power-up rotation. So I want to throw this out to you guys. And, you know, I think I'm going to go first to Carrington, who I think has the most Spartan collection of any of us. And you know, maybe that's part of the trick here, is just don't get crushed by your retro computer collection. But what do you think about this, Carrington?
Well, I would say a biannual turn-on fest is something that would be vastly overestimating my love life. Also, I would argue that the best way to enjoy a large retro computing connection or collection is to know somebody else with one. I think my life is better with less stuff. I'm very happy that I don't have a big collection. I would like to have less stuff than I have now. I always feel better when I drop ballast. But that said, I am not a good person. So my life is basically defined by other people doing good things. And I appreciate that the world is better from other people's efforts. So I appreciate that other people save stuff from landfill. I want it to be saved from landfill. I want people like Jason Scott to go off and save the data that I'm glad other people are willing to put effort into saving. I leech on the world, and it is not a good thing. So I don't think people should do as I do. The world would not be improved if that was the case. So I'm glad that other people save things and restore things and test things and document things and archive things. And if while doing that, you also amass a collection of stuff that adds value to your life and that you enjoy, that's amazing. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and it's awesome. But it's also not for me. Less stuff, more freedom is what I say, and I don't want a big collection, and I'm very happy I don't have one. But I'm glad that other people do, because you save things that I want to exist, but I'd be way too lazy to save on my own.
That's a really interesting comment about enjoying a big computer collection by knowing someone that has one. I know that in some areas, like in particular, I'm thinking of the March organization there on the East Coast, that there's a bunch of these computers that they have in a open storage space. You know, people can come play with them and use them and that sort of thing, but they don't have to be stored at any particular person's house. I wonder if something like that idea might be scalable to various regional groups, where rather than a bunch of people trying to have this giant hoard collection in their own basement or whatever, you could have not museum kind of scenario, because that gets to be a little too stuffy, but just an area where y'all get together, kind of like they have hacker spaces. These would be retro computing spaces. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, but that would be interesting to me. I mean, I would probably move some of my collection to a space like that and put together with a bunch of other people's collections. That could be really fun.
Or a retro computing lending library. Like, so like if I could borrow for a short time, like a Candy Coco 2 or 3, that'd be amazing. But I don't want to have one forever. I don't want something that I have to take care of and have space for and stuff. But if I knew people, like if there was, like you can borrow a book, if I could borrow a retro computer, or maybe get like a ring of people and everybody has one retro computer, and then like the first of the month, you send it off to the next person. So it's like a linked list of retro computer fans. And then you send off yours and then you get a new one. So, oh, look what I got. It's a whatever. And you have it for 30 days and you pass it on. That I can get behind.
Fascinating. Huh. These are some interesting ideas. I think they deserve some more fleshing out here. Paul, let me go to you next. What do you think?
Well, okay, one thing I think is that, Evan, you can stop typing. The march is called VCF Mid-Atlantic. it used to be called March, but they changed their name when whatever it is, Vintage Computer Federation started up. But that actually does seem like a kind of a neat idea to have. I mean, so VCF Mid-Atlantic has at the the Info Age Science Center this VCF museum that has a bunch of stuff out that you can kind of look at, and they have this big there's a big secret storage area. I don't know, I haven't seen it anytime recently. I think it's in a different place now, but where all that the sort of actual stuff that isn't being displayed is, I think it might be monthly little workshops where people go and work on the individual machines and try to, you know, fix up certain things. And, it is kind of a nice sort of community. I have only been sort of eavesdropping. I've been to the Info Edge Center once, but, I like the idea of having sort of making little smaller groups. You know, I mean, that's a warehouse sized thing. So it might actually be pretty cool to have, just sort of in a city, have something like a hackerspace where it's not free because it costs something to, you know, procure these things and store them and rent on the space and stuff like that. But it still might be less than what it takes for everybody to buy the things on their own. So,
yeah. In terms of individual collections, what do you think about that? Because you've amassed quite a metric tonnage of retro computing at this point.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I had noble goals at the beginning. So, at the very beginning, my entry into this was I read. I think I went home, you know, I would periodically see my old computer when I would go home for holidays and stuff. But, I read a blog post that Jason Scott posted, I don't know what it was, 2011 or something like that, saying, you know, like, you blew it, your floppies are dead, you know, too bad for you. And
I remember that post.
Yeah, and
in his gentle way.
It called a lot of people to action.
Yeah. And so I thought, oh, you know, I have a bunch of floppies and I don't want them to be gone. And I was, you know, hitting nostalgia age. And so I thought, all right, well, I will buy myself an Apple II GS and I will image my floppies. And then things never stopped arriving. So, fairly quickly, I moved from my own sort of view of, like, I want to save my stuff, to there's actually a lot of stuff that isn't saved. I kind of want to save that stuff, too. I want to scan it. You know, sometimes there's kind of not-so-great scans of things that already out there, but, you know, they were done 15 years ago, and the scanners were pretty poor, and everything was black and white, and, you know, now we can do better. And so I thought I would start this sort of archiving project, and, you know, sort of take videos of using old computers and that sort of stuff. And that's still kind of my goal, but the problem is that there isn't, that takes time to do. And so, I've done some of it, some percentage of the stuff that I have. I've every single thing I've got, I kind of still want to deal with in a real way. And you know, at this point, there's so much that it's kind of piled in a way inaccessibly. So it's kind of hard for me to do any one thing, because it's just like I have to dig through everything to get to any one thing. And I'm starting to sort of feel like, you know, I'm not a responsible steward of this stuff. You know, like I have gotten it, so it is not gone, it is not tossed. You know, it is saved from the landfill. But you know, it's just sitting in various things I've gotten, and they're sitting in their box. And then, you know, I got them 4 years ago, and I think it'll make an interesting video, and it'll be interesting to write up an essay about them, and, you know, take pictures of everything and archive all the stuff. And I don't know when I'll get to it, and somebody else doesn't have it and isn't doing that archiving while I have it. So, you know, my, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. You know, I am definitely glad that things get saved from landfills, and, you know, I would take stuff, but I certainly, now I look at these big, you know, these big lots, and I just think, I just can't deal with this. You know, they have no place to put this. It's going to take me forever. So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think I see all the angles. I worry that in my, you know, even though I believe that I'm saving things and going to be archiving them for posterity, I do kind of wonder if I'm slowing things down somewhat. So, and yet I've spent a lot of money getting these things, so I'm not sure that I actually necessarily just want to hand them out either. So, don't know.
Interesting challenge. I think actually you've accomplished probably the first and most important thing, which is
admitting I have a problem.
No, it's not that. Not the 12-step of retro computing. No, I can stop anytime I want. I think just having them not pass into oblivion, you know, rage against the dying of the light kind of thing, is a good thing in and of itself. So, you know, as time goes on, maybe there'll even be more efficient ways to archive these things. For instance, this outfit in Colorado that was selling new PX8s, mm-hmm. Epson Geneva computers in the box, I had contacted one time and said, hey, what else you got? They said, well, we got a ton of these floppy disks for the old PX8s and some other accessories. Wait, you know, $75 and it's yours. So I bought it. And I took all the disks and I imaged them. I archived them. And I even store them in the cloud so that they don't get lost if my house burns down or whatever. But now I've got to take the next step, trying to go and find out what the heck is on all of those disks. And does anyone care? Is it somebody's SuperCalc spreadsheet about their chicken feed collection? Or is it actual good technical data, interesting programs or whatever that could be useful to somebody? I don't know. And you're right. That's going to take a huge amount of time. It's probably worth it so that data, that information doesn't go the way of the dodo, but I don't know when I'm going to get to it. So, Michael, you, I believe, have built a wonderful retro cave so that you can enjoy your collection, not just the computers themselves, but a large amount of documentation. What do you think about this question of a big collection and how do we enjoy it, and, you know, how should we properly care for it?
Well, I think the big danger is of it collapsing in on me. There's just so much stuff here. And I have been forcing myself to a little bit of curation so as to limit what I've been getting hold of. But I agree. The first step is actually stopping the book, the computer, the peripherals or whatever from going into landfill or being recycled or anything along those lines. Of course, you then have to take those steps so that it's when you're no longer here to enjoy them or any other reason that it just doesn't make an easy, oh, here's a nice big pile of stuff, let's just shovel it into the skip and get rid of it. So not only do you want to sort of like slow it down and keep it out of oblivion, you need to make sure that in the future that it doesn't sort of make a quick side trip there. So I've lately had made the hard decision of limiting the amount of big box equipment that I'm getting. I'm pretty much trying to not get extra computers and bits and pieces, but concentrating back onto my first love of books, which ironically retro computers, I think, grew as a cancerous outgrowth of my book collecting. I didn't mean to get into retro computing. I had my original Apple IIc that I bought back in 1984, and I just kept going past it, and then suddenly I decided to get some extra bits, get some other machines, other brandage from around that period, and then as all cancers, they just start small, they're insidious, they creep in, and then suddenly they explode into a giant tumor, which is a good way of describing the mess on my desk here at the moment. But I really think that with all good intentions that collectors start off with, it's then learning or gaining some discipline to actually do something with it, even if it's just to find someone else to take it on. Do you really need to have half a dozen 5 1/4 inch disk drives for one particular machine? If it's your main imaging device, maybe. If it's just because you keep tripping across them, you've got to look at getting them out to other people. And really, do we really need to save another Apple II or a Commodore 64? They're nice machines, but they are still fairly common. Do we really need to be now concentrating on the little oddball brands, the clones, the small manufacturers? We need to sort of look at, are we focusing our hobby or our endeavor where it can do the most good and also get you the most enjoyment and satisfaction at the same time? So I've basically sort of trying to redirect my energy so that it's more focused and less chaotic.
Huh. Very interesting. And I think in terms of focusing, one of the things that I've had trouble with is I've got these kind of machines and these kind of machines and these kind of machines, and whenever I think of giving one of them up, it's just like gut-wrenching to think. I don't want to give that particular one up. Let me give this one up. Not that one either. So, yeah, a bit of a challenge. One technique that I've come up with recently is to look at the collection and say, if it's something that I'm not actively working with or having fun with, why not? And is that something that I can change? And if I can change it, I'll go ahead and do that. And if I can't, it's probably time to sell it or to pass it on to somebody who would enjoy it more. For instance, I had a IBM PS2 Model 30. But it had a problem. The hard drive in it was kaput. This was pretty common for the Model 30s. They had these weird ESDI drives, very difficult to find, difficult to replace. So I thought, I'm not going to play with this. It's just going to sit around. What can I do? So I bought one of those XTCF Lite cards that you can put in it that lets you use a compact flash as your hard drive. That worked great. And now all of a sudden that computer's out, it's on the table, it's something that I'm playing with on a weekly, if not daily basis. I'm looking at that and going, okay, I made the investment in that, it cost me a little money, but now that's back on the table. Now let's go to the next thing. Here's another computer, for instance, my Sun Ultra 30. Is there a reason why I'm not messing with it? Well, because I can't get video out of it for some reason. So I should figure out, am I going to keep that? Am I going to try and fix it? Will I get the video out of it? Or should I pass it on to somebody else who needs that system to complete their collection? And I'm just going to go through one by one with these computers and figure out, is it going to stay in the fold, or, is it going to move on. I'm definitely, as one of the listeners put it, I want to be, above all other things, a no-kill shelter. You know, I'm never going to send anything to the landfill myself if I can help it at all. So, well, have we beat this topic to death or any other comments?
Have less stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come up again, but yeah.
I think so.
I must admit, I did actually end up donating half a dozen machines to another collector who was just starting off. These were my early Macintosh laptops. I got rid of a whole, as I said, half a dozen of them because he was specifically wanting to collect laptops, not just the Apple ones, but also similar ones of the day. So I was able to get pass on some DOs through to Wall Street and a couple of others. So it was heart-wrenching to drive over and basically pass them over, you know, because you know, you get out the computer, you get out the peripherals, and then the manuals and everything that goes with it, and it was quite a painful experience. But I'm glad that someone else has now got those machines as part of their main collection. So there is happiness in the pain.
Well, it's difficult to quite come to terms with the idea that I actually have so many projects ahead of this one that this will never get done, you know, and I think probably there are such projects. It's just hard to identify them or believe that that's true. Maybe that's part of what makes it sad.
Yeah.
Also, eventually, you got to think when our generation and ones plus and minus one generation from there retire, there's going to be a lot of people with a lot of technical experience and funding and time on their hands. And very interesting things should come from that, I think.
True, true. Yeah, I was actually thinking, I was thinking a little bit about the possibility that we were at the peak at this point because everybody is the age that everybody is. You know, like the people who got these 80s computers in elementary school are, you know, at nostalgia age and it might be dipping off, but that's true. Then there will be retirement age and the time. So maybe it will last a little longer, but you know,
it'll be funny what happens to just things in general when you have like thousands and thousands of very experienced programmers saying, you know, I'm basically retired. I got nothing else to do, but maybe write some software and release it for free. Screw you young programmers trying to make a name for yourself. I don't need money. So too bad. I'm going to be a downward force in the economy or who knows what, right? So just interesting things are going to come
about. Well, the young people won't be programming in AppleSoft, so it'll be all right.
They're missing out.
COBOL.
Yeah.
Well, let's move over to listener feedback, and for that, I'm going to hand it to the undisputed king of listener feedback.
Hooray!
Paul?
Okay, so continuing our Jorma Fest, Jorma wrote in to tell us that the Finnish Museum for Games is now open, and there's a nice...
In other words, it's Finnish?
That's right. The process of opening it...
Can't believe I'm not the one who said that.
Yes. Okay. Right. So there's a quite nice, you know, nice sort of website about this, and there's a YouTube video. The YouTube video is sort of a wander around the place. So if you are somewhere near Finland, then you should go. But it's neat to look at it anyway, and it's neat that something like this is opening now. So it has a lot of console games and, you know, sort of lots of older tech, so. And I think it's playable, too, actually. Or at least a large proportion of it is. So, anyone planning to go?
I think our closest correspondent is Jack.
Yeah, Jack could pop over for the weekend, but it's definitely not on the way to anywhere for me, yeah. Unfortunately.
But I have to say, yeah, no, I'm much more aware of the sort of computing environment and history of Finland than I was before I started hearing from Jorma. So thanks. So Jeff wrote in mentioning a documentary called Under the Radar, which was actually that was pretty cool. So it is a little documentary about a team of Canadian engineers racing against NASA to be the first to design a computer processor that could transform satellite radar data into images of the Earth's surface. And it's a pretty short documentary. It's a little 9-minute thing, but it's kind of highlighting Canada's contributions. And it was, I think, as I recall, I did watch it, but again, a little while ago, but it's basically a filmmaker interview discovered that this was a project that her father was working on, and so she kind of turned it into a documentary. It's pretty cool if you haven't seen it. Okay, Peter wrote to point out a YouTube video that he made showing the process of imaging 8-inch floppy disks for a TRS-80 Model 2 or Model 16 using a Catweasel MK1 and image disk. And it's pretty cool. He just sort of walks through the process and shows how the software works and, you know, successfully images Pascal or something like this. So if you were curious about this, it's, you know, here you can see it in action. And I guess the last thing that I will mention is that Mikai wrote in to say that the European Vintage Computer Festival is in Munich in, April 29th and 30th this year. So there's a link to the vcfe.org site that mentions this in a little part up at the top, and there's an actual schedule in German as well. And we'll have a link to both of those in the show notes.
So I used Google Translate because I wanted to actually see the schedule. It's a shame that the English version doesn't actually have much information on the VCF 18 other than the dates. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in a little bit more detail, you can take the link that we have that's in German, run it through Google Translate, and it will tell you what's going on.
Ah, cool. I'm doing that now. But yeah, I mean, it's useful to know, you know, like the word for lecture room and that sort of thing.
Yes. So.
But yeah.
Nice.
Looks interesting.
Yeah, and 18. They've done 18 of them, which is just awesome. You know, while some of the other shows have either had a hiatus or one thing or another, that Europa show has just been going on year after year, which is really cool. So let's go to the items of interest. Carrington, I don't even know what Apple's HAL is. What is this all about? Have they developed artificial intelligence that will send us out airlocks?
They did, but it was back in the 1990s, and it was just for a commercial. So most people, when you think of Apple Super Bowl commercial, will think of their big one from 1984 commercial. And some people will know that they followed that up the next year in 1985 with the Lemmings commercial. It did not go over as well. So then they kept away from doing big Super Bowl commercials for quite a few years. But then in 1999, they took another swing at it with the third and I think last big Super Bowl commercial from Apple, which was their HAL commercial. So it was just, you know, big shot and zooming in on HAL, the glowing red eye, framed basically just as you would think it would be. The commercial is easily available all over the internet, but we're going to link to a great and very lengthy article about the making of that commercial. It opens with a video so you can watch the commercial itself, but then it dives deep into the making of it, the details of it, the response to it, maybe what went into making it the last one that Apple tried. And I learned a bunch from it that I hadn't realized. I mean, there's little technical things, but you learn that in trying to replicate HAL's voice, the key was there's a hint of a Canadian accent in the voice of HAL, and the actor who played HAL or the voice of HAL originally was a Canadian, so maybe that's why, and that Steve Jobs didn't like the voice at first that he came up with, but then said, okay, no, it is fine. They had to sort of fight him on it, and just tons of little details. It's really interesting. So if you find either Apple's marketing or that sort of thing, or just HAL itself interesting, there's going to be a lot to find and to enjoy in this article, because like I said, it's quite lengthy. Definitely worth checking out. I found it fascinating because I knew much more about the earlier ads than this one. Related to it, we're also going to link to If you want to make your own HAL replica, the Adafruit has a nice little how-to there. So if you want to take on the world or you know, have revenge or something on a roommate, it might be a nice way to go. And you could class up a bit your revenge if you do it HAL style. So we'll link to an Adafruit article so you can make your own HAL too. But I would highly recommend this Making of Apple's HAL article. Any of you guys checked it out yet?
I did. If you watch the commercial first, you will think that there's only about 9 words you could write about it. I mean, it does sort of like this. It doesn't feel like there's that much going on in the commercial. It sort of slowly zooms in on HAL, and it talks about, you know, the Y2K. But the article itself is very long. It's interesting, but it's amazing that there's so much behind that 1 minute spot or whatever.
I agree. Yeah, definitely worth checking out. If this at all sounds interesting to listeners, I would strongly recommend you check out the link.
Cool. I haven't checked it out yet, but I'm going to go over and have a look because the production of things like that is really interesting to me. It's always fascinating how many hours or days of work goes into something that might air in 1 minute. So, cool. Well, I guess I'm next up here. I'm going to talk about going forth. Tony sent us in a link, and it's from Hackaday, one of those great sites that we love that cover people who are building and making neato stuff, neato gadgets. And this article is Forth, the Hacker's Language. And the article covers kind of an intro to Forth, explaining where it came from, what's it all about, how it works, and why it would still be relevant today. Forth was big back in the 70s and the 80s. Very good language for dealing with constrained environments. So it was perfect for small computers because it was built for small computers. And it allowed you to get a lot of bang for your buck in terms of programming. But people's complaints about Forth include that it uses a stack-based kind of reverse Polish notation approach to doing operations and function calls, and that melts their brain. Also, the fact that the way that you put Forth programs together by building a vocabulary of words and then making sentences, and people have called it a write-only language. That you can create programs in Forth, but good luck ever figuring out what in the world you were trying to do. Now, I don't think that's true if you properly comment them. But I'm a Forth enthusiast, so, you know, that's my opinion. You're stuck with it. Anyway, I think it's interesting that Forth is having something of a revival these days because of little microcontrollers. Again, you've got constrained environments without a lot of processing power, without a lot of RAM, but yet you can make them do fun, interactive things with Forth, because that's what it was built for. So go have a look at the article, and then if you're up for it, there are a variety of different microcontrollers that you could pop Forth onto and give it a try, and some of them are really cheap. For instance, I've got my $4 ESP8266 microcontroller. It's a Wi-Fi microcontroller. Really neat. And I put Puny Forth on it. And I'll tell you one thing. Like a lot of the Forths that were designed for the early 70s microcomputers, sorry, not early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, Forth will let you point the gun at your foot, pull back the trigger, and it'll actually pull the trigger for you if you do the wrong thing with stacks. I rebooted this microcontroller probably 3 or 4 times just goofing around with it because I popped the stack too far or something like that, and bang. So Forth's not a language that will protect you from yourself. My favorite quote from this article is, Forth is what you'd get if Python slept with assembly language. And thanks to Tony for sending that in and for giving us some more fun things to play with.
There were a couple of other things that... do you want me to mention these?
Yeah.
The in response to that article, the Hackaday article, someone named William Wong wrote a little article, which we'll link to. It's called Forth Redefined. The thing that so sort of like reminiscing about Forth, but what I thought was kind of interesting about this was that... So William Wong was formerly of Rising Star. Rising Star came up sometime in the past. I feel like we talked about this once already, but So these are the people who made Valdox and Valdraw for the Epson QX10. And there's actually, so it's interesting to kind of read his thoughts about this, because I think Valdraw specifically was largely in fourth, and Valdox had pieces in fourth. And so he sort of reminisces about that. William Wong also had written sometime previously a blog entry of just like what it was like to be at Rising Star. And there's a pretty interesting little video called A Gathering of Magicians that aired on a CBC show called Man Alive, which was actually really about Rising Star and the way in which they were going to kind of like save the planet with their Valdox software. It was I found it sort of amusing in the magnitude of the effect they expected to have on the world.
It was quite ambitious. Yeah. And they were a distributed team of people writing this software. They actually, for the day, had quite a progressive approach to software development. If I remember right, you and I tweeted about this poll.
Yes.
That there were a couple of challenges they were facing. One is their goals were very ambitious. And the second is that the hardware that they were trying to run this on was just really sweating it out, trying to do the things that they wanted to do. I mean, the ambition of having a full what you see is what you get, clean editing with very user-friendly. I mean, even the keyboard was custom designed for Valdox so that everything would be perfect. So, you know, they tried to put together quite an impressive system, but, you know, technology is hard and it fights back. So they had some challenges there, but I definitely back then I admired what they were doing. Those were my Epson days, so I was right in the thick of it. And I have actually lost documents of my own to Valdox and it's crashing, so but I can tell you what they did was really neat.
Cool.
And we talked about that back in the 80s, that they were putting some of this together with Forth. And back then, Forth was just complete magic to me. I have to admit, I hadn't even heard of Forth until just a few years ago. All right, well, moving on to the next thing. Michael, you've got something about Donner 3000. I hope that's not the same as like the Donner Party, because that would be sad.
Well,
if so, the number will keep counting down.
Yes, but if you do read it there, this one, it can bite you. But yeah, this is an analog computer. So what we have here is a restoration project for the Donner 3000. So it's from 1958. And, you know, as I said, it's interesting. I always love teardowns of older computers, especially ones that have dodgy power supplies and valves and hanging wires. And this one has it all. Even from little things along the lines of plus 570 volts being isolated with adhesive paper tape and how that's pointed out as being possibly not a great way of doing it. But if you progress through the article, you'll see the typical dust-encrusted early electronic style, very reminiscent of early valve radios. But you've basically got suspended components, which are, you know, really only being held in place by the wires that are connecting them to the switches and the relays and to the bases of the valves. And then you get little gems in there where they're showing how even just the interface. So you've got the chrome dials, and you know, they've gone all pasty and slightly oxidized, and how they can be just restored with a bit of cleaning and polishing, and they just end up just really sparkling, literally. It's one of those sorts of projects where you just get lost in just the little bits and pieces that they're doing, and also just looking at the old insulated cables that are perishing and having to more carefully check out for your own safety as well as for getting the machine running to sort of survive. Towards the end of the article, they're showing the decayed mains power leads and how the coating is perishing and brittle and breaking off, leaving just the cotton wrapped wires inside. So highly recommend it. It's not really something which I can see much use for apart from a restoration point of view, which basically would mean that if I'd come across it, I would have bought it myself as well. If you're into the ye olde computers, this one is definitely something to look at. It is beauty to behold.
It is. This is aesthetically gorgeous. I'm looking at some of the last pictures here as they've cleaned this up and put it back together. And what an awesome kind of thing to do. I mean, just beauty to behold, I guess. You know, this reminds me in a slightly newer computer, but on Chicken Lips Radio, we covered a person who had found or purchased a pet computer, and the thing absolutely looked like it had sat in the back of a pickup truck for decades. It was in horrendous shape, rusted out, scratched, almost unrecognizable. And he took it, and with a variety of metalworking techniques, grinding, priming, sanding, painting, took that, what probably most people would have thrown into the garbage, and turned it into a pet that looked like it had just come off the assembly line. And if you haven't seen that set of videos, I'll see if I can't dig up the link to them. We could link to them here too. But the same sort of thing, taking something that's old and crusty and probably for most people beyond repair and turning it into something beautiful like this. And especially these old analog computers, they have such an interesting place in computing history as well as just being such a gorgeous... Do you know what time frame this is from? Is this the
60s? It's the Inbent's article. I think it's the top. So he says it's from 1958.
58, yeah.
Yeah,
it looks like that circa of technology, doesn't it?
Yeah, where it's gone totally away from the cotton-wrapped wire insulation to the sort of the hybrid wrap and sort of a rubberized coating. But it still has all the hallmarks of those earlier valve devices as far as the wiring harness and everything in there. But... yeah, there's so Bernd Ellman has quite a few other articles in his website, the analogmuseum.org, this is the one that has really caught me, I'm going to be bookmarking this one to see their continuing journey for its restoration so that it finally will see in its sparkling glory.
Neat. Well, thanks for this. I would definitely encourage people to... take a look at this article. And Paul, you've got some articles, it looks like, here on computer design.
Yeah, so these are pretty wild. There's three that I wanted to highlight in here. But so these are on a site called, or a site at inexhibit.com. And I'm not actually sure what the entire site is about, but Riccardo Bianchini has three articles here that are sort of history of computer design. And the first one was the most striking one, so that started me down this path, published end of January. And this is a record of the Holborn 9100. And I don't know if you've seen these, you may have, because they're the best looking computer I've ever seen in my life. it's a Dutch computer. And I've never seen one in real life, but, they're white. They have this monitor that's sticking out, you know, alien style. It is absolutely fantastic. And so this article actually goes through with, has a bunch of pictures of you know, people using the computer and discussion of how it's designed and some ads from the time, some photos from 2001: A Space Odyssey. And it's pretty wild. Has anyone seen this computer before?
I've never seen one in person. It almost seems like there was a YouTube video recently where one of these was in there, and I thought the industrial design of these was fantastic. And of course it does harken to the 2001 Space Odyssey sort of design aesthetic, but yeah, these are cool. Yeah. I would love to see one in person.
I agree. I think it's stunningly gorgeous. Never seen it before. My first thought was it was like a personal computer designed by the people who did the computer space arcade game. It's got that kind of swooping shape to it. And you're right, it's kind of like a head on a stalk that sticks up. It also looked to me like it had better ergonomics than pretty much anything from the period, because the monitor being higher and a nice-looking keyboard. It's just, I thought it was amazing, totally stunning. I take back everything I said about collecting. Everyone should have a bunch of these.
Yeah, I'm sure they're near impossible to get, but I would love to have one.
You have five of them.
No, but I would love to have one just to display. But okay, so I said there were three. There's the second article is on the Commodore PET 2001. So that sort of goes through in fairly nice detail and with lots of photos on the sort of design decisions, and also has photos from 2001's Space Odyssey. Apparently the font that was used for the actual PET letters on the front of the computer is the same as what HAL used on its screens. So that's nice. But yes, this also, I mean, the photography is great. Pictures of little computer labs full of pets and ads and little decisions on that. And then there's a third one that actually just appeared, which is the Olivetti Programma 101, which is very old computer, 1965. The first human-centered computer, it is claimed, although you can't say first anything, really, and be right. But so that's also interesting. Check out all three of these articles and bookmark it for looking for future articles as well, if there are going to be more.
Strong agree. The photography is unbelievable in these, and crazy amounts of info, lots of stuff I'd never even seen before. I mean, this is the find of the show. Fantastic. This exhibit site is a definite bookmark and definitely something I will return to.
Well, so tech incubators are kind of a big deal again these days, but apparently Nolan Bushnell had one in the 1980s.
Indeedy do. So when I think of Nolan Bushnell, I think, oh yeah, the Atari guy, right? So, but it turns out he actually...
Oh, the Chuck E. Cheese guy.
Right. But he invested in a ton of companies, just like bonkers numbers of companies. He says he has 5-year ADDs where he just like wants to invest in things and build them up. And then within 5 years, he wants out because he just gets bored of it. So it turns out in the early 80s, basically from like 1980 to 1986, in rough sort of numbers, there existed this thing called the Catalyst Group, which was a venture capital group that invested in a lot of tech and a lot of companies and ideas that were in generally way ahead of their time. In a lot of times that was its downfall. Like a lot of times it's like too ahead of its time. They'll invest in something that 5 or 10 years later becomes something that can exist and is just like, you know, a great idea, but the tech doesn't exist or what have you. So in general, he says maybe like half the companies kind of made money, a couple of companies broke even, all the rest lost money. Like just wasn't necessarily a big success, but a ton of variety, ton of interesting companies involved in this. And this is a really nice article that kind of goes over this Catalyst group and the various things that did. It ran things like Androbot, which did personal robots for like entertainment, which you can see would come from his pizza time things, and invested in something called Axion, I think it was called, that did AG Bear, which was a little teddy bear that would talk and listen to you and speak back, and ETAC, which was a company that was the first one to digitize maps of the entire world and basically laid the foundation for what would be Google Maps and MapQuest and stuff, but just, you know, did it in 1981. Just like crazy ahead. So that was one that was a big success, and many others that were massive failures. Just a huge variety of stuff really opened me to the idea that Nolan Bushnell just has a much bigger footprint in things than I was aware of. Very, very impressive. Neat that he does so many moonshots. And really an interesting article that just does a big summary, just like let's just do a 5,000-foot view of just this period and all the things he was investing in. Entertaining, lots of neat photographs, and I learned a lot from it. So strong recommend, even if it is a Fast Company article. I'm not usually a big fan of them. They're sort of fluffy. This is also fluffy, but interesting.
And also it's a Benj Edwards article, so that may explain why it's perhaps better.
I didn't realize that. Oh, well done, Benj. No wonder this is better than a typical Fast Company thing.
Yeah, this is a thing. So that Axelon, it's Axelon, the toy company. One thing that's sort of interesting about that is that they possibly earlier were a RAM disk company. So so you can get, they had a sort of like disk two sized RAM disk that you could get for the Apple II and allegedly for the Apple III. And they had an Atari, did Atari RAM as well. And I don't know how they transitioned into a toy company, but it, in fact, it's got to be the same company because it has the same logo. So, anyway, if you look in old magazines that had Apple II focus, you'll probably see the ads for these Axelon RAM disk 320 drives.
It's super cool. Anyway, the article was I hadn't realized most of this. I kept thinking, really? 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 Like, that was sort of my experience reading it. So learned a ton from it.
I didn't know any of this stuff either, really. It's very interesting to see how all these things connect.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm really excited to read this. Cool. I hadn't read it yet, and I'm now very much looking forward to it. So, Michael, what have you got on C64 software here? I think you've got a link to Protovision, which is still a ongoing game house for the Commodore 64. Still cranking out new cool software. What are they doing with Civ?
Well, it's definitely, in this case, it's some new old software, or it's going to be old new software. I can't quite figure out which one. But the important thing is that they are filling a great hole in Civ gameplay. They are bringing to the 8-bit Commodore 64 Civilizations. So they've given it the real snappy working title of 8-bit Civilizations. It's available as a playable download, a playable demo. And in the link, you can see the gallery. So there are some excellent screenshots of the gameplay in action. It looks to me to be quite an enjoyable implementation of it, and very complete. If you look at the features, very complete as to what they're offering, and they also list what they're currently working on. So when this is done, this is going to be, I believe, quite a good implementation of Civilizations. Now, I'll definitely have to get that C64 up and running so that I can play this on the real metal, but of course emulators are available. But this will fill a very sweet spot. I'm a great fan of the original Civ and Civ 2. Well, actually, I do prefer Civ 2. Whenever I get a new machine, I always make sure that I test how it can run DOSBox, and then I run the original Civ 1. Then I continue on and load Windows 3.1.1 so that I can play my favorite version of Civ 2. So it'll be good to actually finally get to play Civilization on a C64.
This is so neat, and the screenshots do look beautiful. So, Civilization as a genre, can you give us a little primer on, because this is an entire genre of games, right?
It
of
is.
Which this is one of the preeminent examples.
Yeah. So basically from about 4000 BC to modern day, and your winning options either are rule / blow up the world / get your spaceship to another planet. I always like to go for the world domination win. with or without the use of nuclear weapons. A little bit sad I missed out on the previous show, because that was one of my favorite websites, the Forever War of Civilization. I must admit, I've never let one of my games go quite that long. The longest I ever let it go for was to about 3000 AD, and then I just basically nuked the living bejesus out of everybody.
Vote for Michael!
Well, I mean, you get bored.
Oh, no. Well, that's it. I solved my boredom by playing with nuclear weapons.
Don't vote for Michael.
Yeah.
So in one of these, you explore, you collect, you conquer. Is that
you start off with just a single settler unit. You do a little bit of exploring. You set up your first city, your civilization capital. So I normally play the Romans. I just have a soft spot for imperialistic, world-conquering empires.
Well, let's face it, who doesn't?
Yeah, that's right. It's fun for all the family. There's interaction as you bump into and grind over other civilizations. You can be diplomatic. You can trade with them. It's quite good. But as I said, this has been a bit of a hole in the Civ game. As they say in their preamble, that civilization is pretty much of the 16-bit era. That came out for the later DOS machines, and then predominantly from there on, it became a Windows game. But yeah, it's quite good. I'm definitely going to give this one a go. As I said, I prefer Civ 2. I think Civ 2 basically took the great playability of the original Civilization game and gave it the necessary graphics and gameplay just to polish it up. I own nearly all of the subsequent games of Civilization, but apart from just getting in and playing them and trying them, I always seem to gravitate back to the original DOS version and the Windows 3.11 Civ 2 version, so I suppose they're my classics.
Fun.
Plus, I also do like having my own little goals. You know, I always like to try and have ironclads and railroad systems to rule the world, preferably before zero AD. I'm very big into scientific research and economic exploitation of my neighbors. So,
there's a party slogan.
Oh, wonderful.
So it's interesting that this is, it's called 8-bit civilizations, I assume, in order to avoid confronting the current owner of civilization. But
I have a funny feeling that confrontation is inevitable.
Also a good party slogan.
But they don't mind calling themselves Protovision. And when you said that, I immediately thought, oh, things will never be the same. Because this is, of course, the company that was in War Games that they were trying to get the game from, that was going to release their game and at Christmas, and so started the whole problem. And I don't know if we ever actually, now I'm just like careening wildly off to the side, but I don't know if we ever linked to this.
Careen away.
But there was a while ago. When was this posted? 2013. Somebody actually figured out what magazine that ad was in by searching, because Creative Computing was in the Internet Archive. They were able to actually figure out where the ad, because the ad was placed in the movie in a real magazine. The thing he was holding was a real magazine. It was Creative Computing, Volume 8, Issue 9. So, at any rate, yes. Unrelated to 8-bit civilizations, but there you go. I'm done careening.
Oh. No, you're not, because I wanted to see if you wanted to cover the emulator news roundup.
Oh, yes, right. Okay, well, yeah, that is a sort of by definition careening. But, so there quite recently there was a post on the best Mac emulators, so February 15th. This was posted on macworldco.uk, and it's pretty thorough, actually. So it covers a lot of different platforms that you can run on your macOS machine. So Apple II emulators, and there are Mac emulators, classic Mac emulators. They mentioned DOSBox, DOS emulators, NES emulators for consoles and things, Atari 2600 emulators. So if you, and running MAME and whatever, it's not interesting to listen to this list, but it is interesting to read this webpage. So if you run macOS in your daily life, this is a good way to see what's available to run C64s and Atari. Anyway, yes, the list goes on. But it's very macOS centered, so if you're running Windows, then that is not much use. However, Tezza has his own list of emulators that we've had in our sort of spare links for a while, because we've been meaning to mention it and hadn't. But so we will link also to Tezza's list of emulators, which run on Windows XP and newer, is how they are listed. And this was updated December 16th. Last year, so not too long ago. So it should be still relatively fresh information. So continuing to run through, Tony sent in a while back in feedback a link to a ZX81 site, which has tapes and hardware and books, and also an emulator that can run all the tapes. So it is a JavaScript, in browser emulator. I've tried it very briefly, but it does seem to work. So you can sort of immediately launch the tapes that are there. That's pretty cool. And for the Burroughs 220 enthusiasts who have been emulating this on their Apple II, Michael Mann has updated his Burroughs 220 simulator, and it now allows you to configure the file names of the I/O ports or whatever, so that you don't have to rename things in the file system. So that's good. That is I'm sure a welcome change, and the masses will be happy.
Well, it is also important to remind people that that is the Bat computer.
Oh.
It's not just any old computer.
Mm.
It's the Bat computer.
That's cool.
So if you want that full Batman experience, then this is the simulator you're looking for.
Is that the Bat computer or the Bat Crime Analyzer computer?
Oh, all the same thing.
Yes.
It's Batman. Whatever, dude. It's awesome. It's Batman.
That's cool. Yeah, I had somehow either forgotten or missed that. So, excellent. I'm sure we talked about this when it was first launched, although it was probably in the flurry of Kansas Fest activities. Also, February 15th, not very long ago, was ENIAC Day, as celebrated by Philadelphia since 2011. So if you, happy ENIAC Day, slightly late. There's a Hackaday article on ENIAC that has a link to a Java simulator if you want to actually see, pretend you're using ENIAC. I've launched it, and that's about as far as I got. It does launch. And I guess the last thing I'll mention in the emulator roundup is that Mike Willigal has got, I think he, I didn't notice this when it first went up, but I think he's updated it. But he, Mike Willigal has a Selby app. It's on the Mac App Store, and there are plans for an iOS version. It's not free, but it's a $5 app, but the cost goes toward the developer membership costs and support for the forthcoming iOS version, so that you can run a Selby on your phone. So, I have purchased the app, I have launched it, and again, didn't really know what to do with it, but I have it now.
Was there ever an Apple II emulator for the classic Macintosh OS, like OS 6?
Yes, there was. This came up actually on the Facebook group, I think, or something recently, but there was one called Two in a Mac that I used a little for a little bit. I have a version of this. It's I think it's like version 2.5 or something. So it must have been going pretty much right away, on the Mac. But and I think it probably runs acceptably fast. But
the reason I was thinking I was thinking on my Windows system, I could run a classic Mac OS emulator, and within that I could run an Apple II emulation. And within that, I could run the Burroughs simulator.
Perfect. Perfect.
And then the world would drop in on itself, Inception style. That would actually be kind of fun. If I do that, I might do a YouTube video of that. Nice.
I would also like to say that, keeping in mind our host topic from this week, emulators take up a lot less room than physical hardware.
That is true.
Right. No ones and zeros are harmed in the making of an emulator.
You could have a big old collection of emulators and not upset a spouse.
Oh, yeah.
Unless you're playing on them all the time. In which case,
that'll be the new slogan. Stay married. Use emulators.
That might require a little additional explanation as far as context. But okay. So now we're getting back to the real, and we got to pay the bills. So here's a message from our sponsor.
Let Atari tell you how the computer business works. Atari buys chips, the competition buys chips. We buy circuitry, they buy circuitry. We buy plastic, they buy plastic. But they have these expensive attachments that add to their price. So you can buy an ST from Atari with more power than the Apple Macintosh SE and more features than the IBM PS2 Model 50 at about one-third their price.
Hey, let's talk about again, kind of emulation. It's not really emulation. You guys think it's emulation? This is the retro computing.
You don't know what you're saying yet.
Gift idea. Sorry. Let me actually say it, and then we can comment on it. You know, that whole causality thing. So, Bluetooth boombox. This was my idea. I was sitting around thinking, what is a gift that would help you enjoy late 70s, early 80s computing? And I thought, well, when I was computing during those times, what was I doing? I was probably wearing members-only jackets and Vans tennis shoes, and I was probably listening to a boombox with some great old late 70s hard rock or early 80s new wave. And going through that on my modern earbuds just didn't sound like a way to relive that experience. So I thought, gotta have a boombox. But then I thought, well, I don't want to buy every 80s tune that I listen to because I'd spend $5,000. I want to do something like Pandora or, you know, one of those streaming services and put it into 80s beast mode and just let it play. But so how do you do this? You get a Bluetooth boombox. Isn't that what you do? And then you stream your 80s music through the boombox. You put it up on your shoulder for bonus points. And maybe even you break dance. It depends on how limber you are. I'm not going to be doing the break dancing. But this is my gift idea. And, you know, the challenge is there's tons of them. So I didn't know which one to pick. So I just picked one that had the classic old boombox look on Amazon. But honestly, there's a bunch of different ones that you could pick from. And they're not terribly expensive. So there you go. Next time you're cranking out your game on your C64 and you want to listen to some Depeche Mode while you're doing it, I think this is the way to do it.
I like that whole scenario.
Yeah.
Except the 64 part, but still, old games, Depeche Mode, I'll take it. I think if you're going to pick a boombox, you have to pick it by how does it look on your shoulder.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
So you can do your funky walk with the tunes playing.
Well, what do you guys think about this one that I picked?
Well, how big is it?
Well, there's not enough chrome in it for me.
It either has a huge handle or it's not big enough for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so this kind of fails that particular test.
Yeah, it has to be what 2.5 feet by 1 or something.
Yeah. Yep. And take 19 C cell batteries.
At least you won't get cassette fatigue on it. I've still got mine from the 80s, a Sony boombox with dual cassette, so you can actually put two tapes in and play both sides of each of the tapes so that you can effectively not have to fill it for about an hour or so. But
an hour's worth of music? That's crazy!
Yeah, I know, it's crazy talk.
Well, that'd be about as long as the batteries would last, too.
Yes.
I wore down my tape, so, you know, my Eurythmics tape was, like, down to the bone.
Even my tapes were metal.
A little bit of 1984, then. Okay.
That's right.
Mm.
So that's my gift idea, and the nice thing is there are choices. You can go hog wild, or you can go inexpensive, but, you know, you need to listen to your 80s music with 80s speakers.
Oh, yes.
It's just personal opinion.
And more chrome. More chrome.
Yeah, more chrome. I agree, Michael. I'll find another one for next time. We can just throw it in as an extra link. So now let's go to some other things that we can buy and add to our collection, bringing us all, you know, full circle to the top of the hour. Carrington, what have you got for us on eBay?
I got three things, and none of them are about Apple. Woohoo! It's crazy time.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
So I'm going full TRS-80 this time with three quick recommends. The main one of which is I like this because it's so cheap. So it's a TRS-80 microcomputer newsletter reprints. So it's a handy little book that reprinted the TRS-80 microcomputer newsletter, and the cover price on it was $4.95. It's a buy it now of $3. And so, you know, a lot of times you don't buy something because you think maybe I can get it cheaper. Well, way to wait 35 years or whatever, you're finally saving yourself that $1.95. Unfortunately for me, it's also $15 shipping, but hey, what can you do? But I just love the fact that it's available, buy it now, less than the cover price. And who wouldn't want TRS-80 microcomputer news? Everybody, that's who I say. And because of that, my second choice is, what if you didn't want the bound reprints and you want the originals? Well, you can get those relatively cheap. And I picked one of the, there's a couple of auctions for them at the moment, but you can get 10 of the issues from 1980 originals for $20. And what I like about these is they are, you know, before when color and such, the early 80s, 80, 81, are regularly available, very cheap. And one of the first gift guide ideas we ever had was to get a bunch of magazines and send them to somebody once a month as a subscription.
Mm-hmm.
One of the downsides to that is often if you want to buy a year's worth of vintage magazines, they can be $100, $200. If you, you know, you can pick up a year's worth at something like Kansas Fest for nothing, that's great. But if you're going to buy them on a place like eBay, it can be a little pricey as a gift. You know, do you want to really spend $200 to give somebody used magazines? This is an example of something that you could pick up a year's worth of these for $20-$25, and they regularly are available. So this is an example of the kind of thing that would be a price effective way to implement that gift idea. So I'm going to link to one of those as well. And my third one was just a cover plate, in case you were missing one, for a TRS-80 Color Computer 2. I have a soft spot for the original silver color computer because I had one, but it has that terrible chiclet keyboard. What's nice about this is it spells color correctly. So if unfortunately you have bought one of those color computers in the US and it's always bothered you that Americans can't spell, then you could pick up this and replace your top plate so that you have color spelled correctly with the U, God Save the Queen, and all that. For $30, you can upgrade your color computer and correct the spelling error on its faceplate. Those are my choices. None of them are Apple. I feel very proud of myself.
Very good. Neat stuff to buy.
I love the cover plate.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, I wonder how much ink has been taken up by throwing in the extra U into color and flavor over the years.
It's very worth it. Very worth it. It adds both color and flavor. We use flavored inks in Canada. I don't know about you guys.
Maple. All right. I'll go next. And, you know, I love printing terminals. I'm sorry. I don't know what it is. It's, you know, just the way they look, the sound that they make, and the fact that I did so much homework on them back in the 80s. So here's one. It's a Deck Letter Writer LA-100. Dot matrix printer, printing terminal with the full keyboard. This one, a couple of noteworthy things. First off, the seller says it works, which is a great thing because a lot of the time when you see these old deck terminals up, the person's like, don't know if it works, no way to test, buy it if you want it, kind of thing. Whereas in this case, they say, hey, it actually does work. Second, as I look over it, maybe a little bit dusty, but it looks like it's in nice shape. A picture of the front and the back. It's got that classic deck keyboard look, which I love the look and the feel of those keys. Looks essentially like the keys that you'd find on a deck VT100, 102, that kind of thing. Also, I did a little bit of reading about this particular flavor of the Deck Letter Writer, and apparently it was a quite capable dot matrix printer. Had the VT100 special characters in it. It had different typefaces built in. You could even put in some typeface font cartridges into the thing. So, you know, what a little work of art here. I think that the price is reasonable for a working deck printing terminal. $200 on a buy it now. Shipping's pricey because these things do weigh a ton. To me, from South Carolina to get this to Portland would cost about $67, which would just about be worth it because the look of this, I don't know. Usually when you find these old deck terminals and they're in working condition, they cost more money than this. Mm-hmm. So I think this is reasonable. What do you guys think?
There's something, for some reason, I am almost most drawn to the badge. I just love the little digital badge there above the keypad. This machine itself, though, it looks like it's in great shape. I mean, like, if I had an extra space this big, it would be tempting.
Usually the dot matrix, I mean, they're noisy, but they're not as noisy as the daisy wheels. Mm-hmm. I have a Xerox daisy wheel printing terminal. That thing sounds like a jackhammer when you turn it on. So at least this wouldn't wake the neighbors if you were using it later at night.
Just singular neighbor.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe just your next door. So, Michael, you've got some cool CPU stuff up here.
Yes, one of them is retro-inspired, and the other two are sort of not really retro, but they're quite interesting. So the first one I've got is a print of an Intel 4004 CPU. So if you just want that something different for hanging up in the lounge room or the den or your office, this looks quite good. So I suppose, on your perspective, I think the price is quite reasonable, $60 US, but it does look quite good. So if you're into the insides of your CPUs and how they look, this is quite a nice piece of artwork.
And I noticed that the paper that they printed on, they said that they use acid-free fine art paper. So this isn't just some cheap print.
Yes, when I saw acid-free, I sort of thought, acid-free, so no tripping on this one. And it has archival pigments. So I don't know for what flavor they are for Carrington, but it's an interesting piece of artwork. Now, the other two items are a little bit more hands-on, a little bit more expensive in one case and quite cheap for the other. The next one I've got is a 6-inch silicon wafer for a 386 CPU. So it's basically the full wafer, hasn't been cut, and it's in a presentation container. Just a tad pricey at $350, but if you wanted something different to use, I could see this being used as a drink coaster. It has a nice circular insert on the presentation case, so make a good drinks coaster, or depending on the size, possibly even something for serving up some chips and dip, I suppose. So.
I think the interesting one on this is that it's a very nice display case, and has the nice polished 386 uncut wafer on the inside. But then they've taken a piece of ugly masking tape and put it on the top there, probably leaving unsightly residue if you go remove that. That just seems to kill the whole thing for me. I wish that they would have taken that off and maybe cleaned it up a little bit. It would have given me a better idea, because otherwise this looks gorgeous.
Okay, now the final one of the series is, if you're wanting something just a little bit more up-to-date than your 386, this one is a 486 CPU die. It has been cut, but it hasn't actually been encapsulated. So if you want to just make your own 486 CPU, here is literally the core of what you need. So quite an interesting little piece, so, you know, maybe make it into a keychain, a necklace for a loved one, I don't know, but, yeah, just something different for your early computing memorabilia, but not really retro. I might get back to whether this 486 is retro maybe in 10, 15 years.
Rule of thumb used to be 10 years.
Yeah.
I think that's not quite true anymore, but still, you know, 486 DX2, you're still looking at, when did that come out? I think you're starting...
Wednesday.
I think you're starting to get retro.
Yeah, I remember my...
that's our new slogan. You're starting to get retro.
Yeah, I remember my first 486 computer. That was, I think, back in 93. So.
Yeah, that's about right. Okay, what, 20 years? That 20 plus years is
when I went over to the dark side.
Ah,
I like that second photo. It's not so the second photo in this 80486 DX2.
Yeah, I think it's not part of the sale though.
Yeah, it does say that it's a second detailed photo micrograph. It's shown for reference only, but it is pretty.
I'd have that up on a nice piece of acid-free paper and have it in down here in the 8-bit bunker.
Yeah, well, just wait for my first auction.
I was going to say, Paul, it's like you guys are channeling each other. Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, so the first thing I wanted to put in here, because it connects in fairly nicely, is the original CAD layout for the Intel 486 microprocessor, signed by Pat Gelsinger, I guess, and staff, who I presume were responsible for putting this together. I do not understand what this is, but it is pretty. You will not want to buy it, almost certainly, but it is nice. It looks like a poster. It is not a poster. It is some actual artifact from the creation of the Intel 486, and it so presumably all those lines are exactly accurate. But it shows sort of a CAD rendering of how things are all connected, and it can be yours. You can make an offer, free shipping, but otherwise you can be yours for the buy it now price of $15,000. So, yeah.
Pocket change.
One of my favorite things is it's 5 feet by 3 feet, and it just makes me think, imagine if that's the size things actually were. This is a 1-to-1 scale. You want your new 486? Here it is.
Yes. Bring your forklift and take it away. And oh, that is beautiful.
It is, and it's 5 feet by 3 feet, but it's still very detailed. the actual size of these things.
Yeah, any smaller, you can barely see all the details even at this size. It's amazing. It also, it's weird when something is and staff. It reminds me of like Gilligan's Island, like the and the rest. Right. It's like, sorry, you're just and staff.
And it does have signatures along the bottom, many of them. It just seems, this seems so reproducible. I mean, like I believe that this is what it says it is, but I, to spend this much money on it would have to be satisfying a very particular sort of need. But yes. Okay. Let's see what else. I had a couple of other things as well that were not related to that. The next thing I had in my list is a Sanyo VM 4509 circa 1980 9-inch monitor. This is a number two thing that I'm not suggesting you buy. But it's sort of interesting just to talk about, I guess. These are it's basically a little security monitor that was relatively easily available in 1980. They're little black and white monitors, and they fit very nicely on top of an Apple II. So they were very often used in like the publicity photos and things for Apple IIs. They fit alongside the disk drives on top of the machine fairly well. And so these days, that has made them very expensive. So you can get a relatively beat up one for $250, buy it now. And the sad thing is, that's actually, I think it's too much. I think it is more than people have spent on these, but it is not crazy expensive for what they go for. So I don't know. They're nice. They're cool. But unfortunately, they're hard to get now. And the thing is, they were kind of cheap at the time. But
yeah, I actually do like the ones that have got a little bit of rough handling on them. This one with the color around the bezel rubbed off. It would be a perfect fit into a retro computer collection. But at $250, you want some serious aesthetic going on with your computers to get this one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the next one I had, so I keep not quite hitting buy it now on this, so I'll put it in the show notes and we'll see if it's still there when this goes out. But this is a 24 volume set, Time Life Understanding Computers. I'm not sure to what extent people know or remember Time Life, but it was basically a subscription model. So you would be staying up late at night watching whatever television program was on, and there'd be an ad where you could subscribe to the Understanding Computers series or whatever series. Time Life had various series of this sort, and they would send you the first one, and then once a month until you had, I guess, until 2 years went by, because there were 24 total of these. And it's not actually very hard to find small, collections of these out there. What's interesting about this particular auction is it has all 24 of them. And they actually, I have not seen them scanned out there, and they don't look too bad from the little bits that I can see in the photos of them. I mean, like, they're, I could find them, I could imagine them being somewhat informative. So I'm kind of curious to read them. So if somebody wants to buy them and scan them, I will happily read your scans. But so computer basics, the personal computer, computer languages, the computerized society, robotics space.
Well, that's the thing is, I think we're burying a bit of the lead here, that I never realized the extent to which when you line all these books up, it is hilarious because it opens with computer basics and security and the computer languages and stuff and goes to input output. And then you scroll down to the bottom as you're getting into year two, it's artificial intelligence, robotic, space, revolution in science, the military frontier, the human body. I'm like, where the hell am I going with this? Yeah. Like, it's just the list of topics gets insane. And I love it. I just think if you look at this as a list of things, one of the ends is like computers of the cosmos, which, and I adore how broad and almost scary these topics get, and it's amazing. I never realized. Yeah. I love it.
Well, it's probably getting toward, it's like, you can see the desperation. It's like, oh, we need to come up with another one.
But the human body, it's like, oh God, what? This has all gone so wrong. I love it. I love it.
Did you mention the date? I think these are 1986. Is when these that's what it showed on Amazon.
Okay, yeah, I did not mention that. And in fact, I don't think I even knew that. So that's cool. So these of course when people got them would vary in a way because of the subscription model. So Computer Basics is quite easy to find everywhere because that was the first one and everybody canceled after that, I guess. But this is one of the only full sets I've seen. So it is. Oh, and it is a $40, $39.99. Buy it now. $10 shipping to me, at least. So it's
only $10 shipping. That's pretty good. Yeah. Won't even ship to Canada, but I was assuming due to the weight, it would be very expensive for shipping.
So you can see why I keep almost hitting the button on this.
For $40, that's crazy. Yeah. And I don't even want to collect anything. But like I said, I want to know people with collections. Paul, I want to know you have this.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll see.
Spent all the work spending.
Yeah, I'm looking for my FaceTime Connect to Paul's computer right now.
right.
But yeah, $40, buy it now. $10 delivery US, but I'm just scared of the thought of what the postage is going to be for when I have it on forwarded to here in Sydney.
See, now you guys are not helping.
it's
quite possible that this will be gone by the time we post this.
When you said
episode.
You wanted some encouragement, I misunderstood you.
Yes.
I can flick you the $10 for delivery and I'll just pop by and read them next time I'm over your way.
Yeah, right. Perfect. Okay, let's see. So let me keep going here. This just seemed weird to me. The next one I have is an Etch-a-Sketch Screeny. It is a screen frame, circa 1993, that looks like an Etch-a-Sketch. I think it actually has... I can't tell if it's printed or if it's actually 3D. I think it may just be printed. The little frame that you put around your screen. So if you have a screen that is small enough for this, then... you can put it on your computer monitor. It looks to me like, well, the whole thing is about 14 inches by 11-ish. So anyway, I had not seen one of these. It is retro on retro.
Me neither. How bizarre.
If you read the back, actually, there's there's all kinds of these you can get. I mean, like, I think this, the Etch-a-Sketch one is the coolest one. The rest of them are all sort of like frames, but,
if you turn the knobs, does it move the mouse?
It certainly should.
If you want to find out, you'll have to subscribe to Time Life Books.
For just basics. 3 easy payments.
Yeah. So you remember these ads?
Indeed.
I'm not sure that I actually remember the computer one, but I definitely remember this, various other ones. Okay, and so the next one is a 32K memory expansion unit sidecar for the TI-99-4A. So this is, we've probably talked about these before, but the TI-99-4A had an expansion slot on the side, and it was, at least for a while, it was kind of common to have these kind of like sidecar things that you would put on the side with an additional slot so you could sort of keep chaining them, so you could have several of these things sticking out the side. And this is a 32K expansion unit, that you could put on the side of your TI-99/4A. Normally, you would, if you were like a real 99/4A user, you would get a peripheral expansion box, which is a huge, giant thing that you would put behind your TI-99/4A, hook it up with, I think, a not super reliable kind of stiff cable, and then put all your expansion stuff in that box. But until there was this expansion box, there was this 32K sidecar. I believe that this is rare. It says it's rare, but I believe that it is. It is a Multicom branded unit, and it is...
Yeah, it's an aftermarket. Mm-hmm. It's not an actual TI.
Yep. So it's a cool thing to see. It has a starting bid of $100, basically. It was just listed, and there are no bids yet. But anyway, if that is your thing, then there, here it is.
I'd also like to point out that it never stops being funny looking at the TI-99/4A with a whole bunch of expansion sidecars out to the side, where you end up with like a 6-foot-wide computer. That is awesome. The whole idea of basically what looks like a fold-out computer. I love it. You TI-99 people are crazy sauce. It's awesome.
And it never really got old for them bumping them and having everything reboot either.
I'm sure. That was, I'm sure.
My favorite is the classic picture. I just Googled to remind me, and it is the massive, massively long chain of these things, with the very far end is the modem, and I just love that. So let me just go over there and answer a call. And anyway, I adore it.
Yeah,
such a funny looking thing.
That I would love to see that photo recreated, but yeah, there is a photo. We will put a link somewhere. We'll point to it, but
again,
yeah. You have to have a like a chair with rolling wheels in order to deal with this computer.
Where's my printer? 6 feet to the right.
I'm going to have that phone port move so that the cable will reach the modem.
Right. Okay, and then the last thing I was going to mention, it is a display writer component, and it is a bunch of things in somebody's attic in Chicago, and so if you are in Chicago and have a rag you can wipe the dust off with, you can bid on and then go pick up these display writer components. So this is the IBM display writer. I think they said there's probably about 3 complete units, although it comes in several pieces, and there are many of several of these pieces. So it looks like there are a bunch of printers. And the story is kind of, you know, it's a sort of short story, but it says, my wife was a display writer operator and fell in love with the machine. As a result, we purchased a number of machines over the years, and we were moving, and to my wife's dismay, we must part with these. So they've been sitting in the attic, and they are for sale individually or collectively, but you have to pick them up. So this is only for Chicagoland people. But I've always kind of liked the look of these. I've never been quite tempted to get one, but they really look nice, particularly, I think, the drives. But, it looks like an IBM machine.
They do. They actually look like one of the old 3278 terminals or something like that. Well, kind of. Are those 8-inch drives? That might be a little tricky, getting some 8-inch media for these guys.
Yeah, I think they are. I think there is software in this pile. Yeah, right. The last photo has a little bit of software, a little small stack of disks.
Ah.
So, if you are in Chicago, this actually did, this was mentioned on something, CC Tech, I think, or something, just recently. So I think the word is out, but it's neat to look at them. It's too bad to have to get rid of them, but they're not doing anyone any good sitting in this attic.
Yeah, these should definitely be saved. Those in that category of stuff that should not go to the landfill. Mm-hmm.
That is it for me.
Cool.
Hooray.
Well, I think we've come to the end of the show. Those were all some great items. This is fun stuff. I'm glad, though, that my piggy bank is a little anemic at the moment, or I'd be buying some of those things, especially that deck terminal. Speaking of spousal killing, I'd be in the doghouse.
But Carrington would be able to solve the mystery.
Exactly. My new Infocom skills.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, I got to listen to that latest episode. Oh, by the way, for the uninitiated, we're talking about Eaten by a Gru. I don't mind podcast cross promotion here. So, Carrington, you know, kudos to you and Kevin. You guys are just killing it.
You just wanted to mention Kevin.
Kevin Savitz. Yes! Just under the wire. All right. Well, let's go to the closing discussions. And Carrington, why don't you start us off? Parting shots.
I've got nothing. I've got nothing. Oh, you know what? I do have something. Paul just mentioned CC Tech, and I heard at the top of the show before we were recording that I guess there was some sort of brouhaha on there about Yale changing one of the college names from Calhoun College to honor Grace Hopper.
Yes.
I want to chime in on that, mostly so we can put a link in. John Calhoun was an awful person and should have nothing named after him. And I'm delighted about this. And Grace Hopper was amazing and should have everything named after her. So I say thumbs up to this. This is what I say. Everything should be renamed after Grace Hopper.
Could get confusing, but I'm good with it.
Nope.
All right. Well, what about you, Michael? What have you got to close us out with?
Well, nothing retro computerish directly, because I'm currently sitting at my desk. Lots of things have got sheets and tarps thrown over the top of it because I've been repainting the ceiling to sort of try and make it a bit lighter and brighter in here. Old failing eyes, working with old failing retro equipment and all that. But apart from that, it's just the inevitable trickle in of new bits and pieces, which I should really get out of their envelopes and boxes. But
That lighting is a good idea. I find that with my weakening eyes over time, that better illumination just makes everything happier, especially when I'm messing with the retro computers, cleaning them up or doing circuitry stuff or whatever. Eye fatigue is no fun.
Yep.
Just kind of makes you tired. So yeah, well lighted.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I had to do it. I've been in here for nearly 3 years now at the new property, so I am glad that I finally got round to repainting the ceilings down here. So we'll see how things go. But yeah, I've got to get back into this retro computer stuff. It sounds fun.
it's kind of a neat hobby. So what have you got, Paul?
Well, yeah, I sort of also feel like I'm, you know, I'm only doing little miscellaneous things. At a certain point, I looked at my, I have this website that I intended to put all this stuff on, and, you know, kind of has enthusiasm in 2012 and then like kind of trailed off as these things do. So I've been sort of messing around trying to redesign that a little bit and lower the friction for getting like scans and images and stuff up there and into some kind of setup. So I've spent a little bit of time with that, working on a kind of like a database, trying to figure out how to interrelate things, how to speed up the general loading time and things like that. And I don't know, it's been kind of fun, but I feel like I haven't actually done any of the retro computing part. I've just been, you know, creating linked tables.
Well, the whole point of a CMS isn't to actually put up stuff, it's to give you a CMS to work on tweaking.
Yep,
forever.
And succeeding.
It's my personal experience is that.
So that's basically it for me. I have unjustified optimism for the things I will do in the future.
Excellent. Irrational exuberance.
Yep.
So I'll close this out. I've been retroing like crazy, and it has been this new kind of approach that I was talking about when we started, that I look at something and I go, what am I going to do with this? If I'm not going to do anything with it, then, you know, let's move it on. But if I am, let's stop stalling. So, for instance, the Model 30, which was a doorstop, now is a very happy, cleaned up computer that I'm using to run all kinds of my old 80s DOS stuff. I even made a YouTube video doing an unboxing of Clipper Summer of 1987, a DBase compiler. Now, this has the number of views that you would expect for a DBase unboxing, which is like 30-something. But hey, at least it's out there for austerity. Like I think a couple of you guys have mentioned, Carrington, I think, Paul, you've mentioned this in the past. It's interesting to see when you open up the box how the documentation was laid out. What did you actually get? And once you've opened it and put it all together and start using it, there's no way to recreate that. So, you know, it's on video. Maybe only 30 people care, but I just thought it'd be fun to do. I'm going to do that with a Novell DOS 7 also. I'll get 30 more views. Pretty soon the money's going to roll in.
Yeah, but it's more that that's the kind of thing about putting up the video. It's now saved forever. So somebody, it might have 30 views now, but it's a viable video for the next 200 years.
Right.
Like, well, a lot of things you stick up on YouTube really have no reason to be watched like 20 years later even, whereas this is the kind of thing that could be of interest to somebody in the year 3000.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, I think you should total up your views after a minimum of two generations.
Okay. If I'm still alive, I'll do that. But yeah, I've been playing with the PDP 11 and I'm sure the electric company loves me on that, but I've been finding some new ways to get software to and from that. A gentleman came up with, posted in the, I think it was a CC Tech, he'd made a file sharing kind of software that you can mount a drive as a tape drive on the PDP 11, and it's also a folder on your Windows computer. You throw files in from one place, and they magically appear in the other place. So it's almost like, a file server sort of thing, but for the old PDP. So that was fun. I've been playing with that. And I ordered a RAM-ROM replacement for my pet. I've got one of the 2001s that has the, not the chiclet keyboard, but the real full-size keyboard. The thing is, Commodore drilled holes in the motherboard of that model so you couldn't add RAM yourself. Now, you guys have probably heard of that, but that's just, to me, that's like the ultimate cheesy. You know, they're like, either you buy the RAM for us or, you know, you're not getting it, pal. But this company in the UK, Tynemouth Software, they make a bunch of add-on boards and I think a ZX80 clone also called the Minstrel. They make a bunch of cool stuff. Anyway, you take the 6502 out, and you put it in this carriage, and then you put the whole circuit board assembly back into your pet. And now, magically, you've got 32K of RAM, you've got the newer ROMs, and yet you didn't make any non-reversible changes to the pet. So it's like an upgrade in place that you can always go back. And I'm really excited about that, because one of the things, I didn't play with the pet, it didn't have enough RAM. And now, you know, I'll go ahead and get that and... So, yeah, Retro Man, I'm having all kinds of fun here.
Excellent. Yeah, I had not heard about the... I'm still a little pet ignorant, that's another one of the projects that I hope to get to someday.
That drilling the holes in the motherboard was so cheesy. I mean, I'm not a part of the Jack Tramiel haters club, you know. I think he did a lot of good, and he, you know, had his warts too, but... in terms of that, you know, the motherboard drilling, I'm like, come on, guys. You open it up, there are actual damage to the motherboard, self-inflicted wounds in this computer. But, you know, it's 2017, so yee-yee. All right, well, I think that's it. I think I've rambled enough, so let's close this baby out. Let's land this plane. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all of our shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this show and all kinds of great retro computing stuff at the VC Federation forums, vcfed.org/forum, and we'll have the link up in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and Ken, our social media, what shall we call him? Our social media czar? Is that good?
Sure.
Superhero?
Overlord.
He posts great... Yeah, he posts great stuff up there.
Chief Tweet.
The chief Tweeter. So thanks, Ken, for keeping that feed alive at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. And a link for that will be in the show notes as well. You can send us feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. As you can tell from all our shows where we read about the feedback, we read it, we love it, and thank you for that. We're a member of the Throwback Network, throwbacknetwork.net. where you can find all kinds of retro-themed shows. And if you like us, please write a review on iTunes, because it helps other people find us. And guys, that's a wrap. So until next time,
Retro Compute!